From the WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
One, two, three, four!
On today's Fresh Air, we conclude our series on cultural heroes by talking about the Beatles with former Beatle Ringo Starr. Then we'll hear about the Beatles from the point of view of a former Beatle wife, Cynthia Lennon. The Beatles, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Democrats and Republicans are squabbling over spending bills for the government's new fiscal year. The bills fund federal departments and agencies, NPR's Chad Pergram reports.
Congressional Republicans want to approve a $310 billion bill that funds the Departments of Labor, Education, and Health and Human Services. But President Clinton has threatened to veto the measure. He contends that the bill doesn't have enough money to hire new teachers. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle of South Dakota says that under the Republican plan, 29,000 teachers hired last year will lose their jobs.
There's no guarantee in the Republican budget that any of those teachers will be back next year. That pink slip should not be a reality for those 29,000 teachers, but that is the reality unless we win this fight.
Congress and the White House are supposed to have spending bills in place by October 1st, the start of the government's fiscal year. The government is now operating on its second temporary extension. Chad Pergram, NPR News, Washington.
A federal court says New York City can force Ku Klux Klan members to go without masks if they want to rally. A civil liberties lawyer says the decision tramples on First Amendment rights. The Klan says some members have lost jobs or were attacked when their identities were revealed. The son of Illinois Congressman Bobby Rush has died after being shot outside his Chicago home. Huey Rich was shot by two men who flashed what appeared to be police badges Monday night. Friends say Rich, who used his mother's name, was named after Rush's friend and fellow Black Panther, Huey Newton. Scientists with the California Pharmaceutical Company say they've identified a long-sought molecule involved in Alzheimer's disease. The finding could lead to new drugs for the brain disorder. NPR's David Barron reports.
Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia, afflicting about 4 million Americans. People suffering from the illness build up clumps of a toxic protein in their brains, and this protein is produced when molecular scissors called enzymes cut up a larger protein. For years, researchers have been trying to identify those enzymes, and scientists at the Amgen Corporation believe they have now succeeded in identifying one of them. Doctors say the new findings, published in this week's issue of the journal Science, could be an important advance. If the discovery is confirmed by others, scientists might then be able to create drugs that block the enzyme and stop the production of the harmful protein. It could take years before such a drug is available, but the new study provides hope that scientists might one day be able to halt what is now an unstoppable disease. David Barron, NPR News, Boston.
Stock prices closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials up over 172 points to close at 10,470. Advances led declines 2-1. The Nasdaq Composite Index was up more than 14 points, ending the day at 2816. You're listening to NPR News. Switzerland has expelled French war criminal Maurice Pepin. The 89-year-old former Vichy official and condemned Nazi collaborator was flown to France from Switzerland today. Lisa Schlein reports.
Switzerland acted with uncharacteristic speed in getting rid of Maurice Pepin. The country is still smarting from the bad press it received for acting as Nazi Germany's banker during World War II. Not wanting to get caught in another international scandal, the Swiss government took a legal shortcut in turning Pepin over to the French authorities. The Swiss justice minister said her government didn't want to be a haven for someone sentenced to jail for crimes against humanity. Last year, a French court sentenced the former Vichy official to 10 years in prison for his role in deporting more than 1,500 Jews to Nazi death camps. He fled to Switzerland in a short-lived effort to escape justice. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Health officials say scores of new cases of dengue fever in northern Mexico indicate the disease is spreading. At least 5,500 people have been diagnosed with the mosquito-borne disease this month alone in Mexico's Nuevo León state. Dengue is characterized by headaches, rashes, cramps, and severe muscle and bone pains. It usually lasts about 2 weeks after infection. The World Bank is investigating allegations that one of its former Washington-based Russian officials passed along inside information to a Russian bank that lost its license last year. The former official, Leonid Grigoryev, has been placed on administrative leave by the Bureau of Economic Analysis in Moscow. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Boys Don't Cry, based on a true story, with Hilary Swank and Chloe Sevigny, now playing in theaters. From Delta Books, publisher of Ithaca, A Daughter's Memoir of Being Found, by Sarah Safian, the story of an adopted woman who is located by her birth parents. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're concluding our series on cultural heroes by talking about the Beatles with a former Beatle, Ringo Starr.
I'm Ringo and I play the drums.
I'm Paul and I play the bass.
I'm George and I play a guitar.
I'm John and I too play a guitar. Sometimes I play the fool.
That's the Beatles on BBC Radio, recorded in 1963 and 64. When I spoke with Ringo in 1995, he told me that he was very sick as a child. He spent a year in the hospital for appendicitis and peritonitis. When he was 13, tuberculosis put him back in the hospital for a year. It was during that hospital stay that he started to play music.
That's where it entered my life, was because to keep us busy, besides letting us knit, they used to let us knit dishcloths.
Oh, wow.
It was really exciting.
Yeah.
And then teacher would come in with musical instruments, being drums, tambourines, maracas, triangles, all percussive stuff. And she'd put this big screen. I'm trying to let you visualize it out there, Radio Land. Big white paper with red notes for the drums, and yellow notes for the tambourines, and green notes for the triangles. And so she would point to these different colored symbols, and we would either hit whatever instrument we had. Well, I had a drum the first session, and I really loved it. And so they came back like a couple of weeks later, and they tried to give me another instrument, but I only wanted the drum, and that's where I really fell in love with drums.
Was that supposed to be physical therapy for you also, since it's such a physical instrument?
Well, we couldn't get out of bed too often. You know, it was a big deal after 6 months in hospital when they said, you can get out of bed now and sit on a chair. Well, that was the big move. But so it was just to keep us entertained. They never really came in giving us maths and geography or things like that. They gave us knitting and making things, you know, paper mache stuff and things like that.
So what was it like for you after you were sick to be playing an instrument that's so physically taxing?
Well, I didn't have an instrument for years later. I made my first kit when I came out of hospital out of biscuit tins and firewood. And then when I was about 16, I got a bass drum. That's all I had, was a big bass drum. And then when I was 18, I got my first kit. So I'd strengthened up by then.
And how old were you when you were actually playing in a band?
1 month later.
After you got the kit?
Yeah. Because I was really lucky, because if in those days, if you had the instrument, you were in the band. And because it was skiffle, so it was real easy. So that's how the guy next door, it was called Eddie Miles, but we formed the Eddie Clayton Skiffle Group, and he was the guitarist, and my best friend Roy Trafford was the other guitarist, and we got another guy on T-Chess bass, and we just went out there and played.
Now, when did you start playing rock and roll?
Very soon afterwards. I left that band, joined another skiffle group, and then I joined a rock and roll band called Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. And we were still sort of folky rock, and Johnny Guitar, our guitarist, we were playing the famous Cavern Club in Liverpool, and he brought a radio in to plug into. And, you know, you can imagine the size of your speaker on a radio. And he plugged into that, and they threw us off because we were playing rock and roll, as we should have just been playing skiffle and folk blues. So, and then it started. We just went from there, and everyone got amplifiers, of course, and we were off.
Ringo Starr is my guest. So how did the Beatles ask you to join the band after they asked Pete Best to leave it?
Well, they didn't do it that way, you see. Pete Best was still in the band, and I was with Rory.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, Pete couldn't make the session, so they asked me to play. And we'd got to know each other in Germany because we were the two bands playing there, the Beatles and Rory Storm. So, you know, we really became friends there. Then we kept back to Liverpool, and Pete couldn't make it one day, and Brian Epstein came and said, would you play the lunchtime session? And I said, sure. And that was it. And then we went for a drink, and that was the end of the story. And then a couple of weeks later, he asked me again to play a couple of sessions, a couple of gigs. And I said, sure, you know, because I just happened to have the time. And then I went away to play with Rory to a holiday camp in England, Butlin's Holiday Camp, where you go for 3 months, you play the summer there in the Rock and Calypso Hall. And we were the rock band, and Brian called me on the phone, and he said, you know, would you like to join the Beatles? Well, I said, sure, I'd love to join the Beatles. And I said, when? And he said, today. And I said, well, I can't join today. That was a Wednesday in 1962. And I said, I can't play today because, you know, the band would be out of a job. We'd have to wait till Saturday because by then we could get another drummer. And that's what happened. And, you know, everybody knows the story from then on.
Well, an interesting part of the story is that you showed up for the first recording session.
Oh, yeah.
Of the Beatles, and the producer,
George Martin.
Yeah, had another drummer all picked out, because I guess he didn't know that you had been chosen to be in the band.
No, he didn't know. Well, he listened to the band with Pete Best and didn't think Pete was going to be on the session. And so he didn't know about me at all. And so he'd got this drummer, Andy White, ready, you know, a professional drummer, a session drummer. And I came down, and I was just mortified. And he said, oh, we've got this real drummer here. I thought, what am I? And he didn't want to take a chance, because in those days, it wasn't like you could go in the studio and just spend your time there. You know, the session was 3 hours. You were in and out. Andy played on the single, and of course, then we re-recorded it, and I played on the album. And I sort of defy anyone to tell the difference. And that was it. But George Martin has apologized over and over again because I've made him for doing this to me.
Well, what did you think the Beatles' chances were of really making it? What was your assessment of the band when you joined it?
I joined the band because they were the best band I'd heard, and that was how I played. I moved my career through Liverpool, of course, to, you know, if I could get into a better band, I would. My aim was to play with good players, and that's what I did. I mean, the aim was not really to, you know, be big and famous. It was just to play with really good people.
So when you joined the band, did you have to do, you know, the Beatles haircut and the suit jacket?
Well, that's the famous line, you know, John came on the phone saying, welcome to the band, but you'll have to get your hair cut and get rid of your beard. And which I did. I didn't have much of a beard then, but I did have my hair swept back. And we had it cut so it fell forward. It was part of the image, and Brian Epstein was moving them into like this image thing too, making them wear suits and, you know, not drinking and smoking on stage. So it was all part of the deal.
Did that come easy for you? Were you comfortable with that? Or?
Oh, yeah, because I'd been in a group that had suits. You know, Rory, Storm and the Hurricane, we were the top band in Liverpool because we had suits. And, you know, everyone else was just in, like they are now, actually, all sort of scruffed up. But we were professionals. You know, it's all funny to think about it now, but that red suit meant so much.
Red, wow.
Red, and we had green suits, so we could change. Big doings in the 60s, I'll tell you, big doings.
No, in the Beatles, did you have to, like, figure out who you were going to be in terms of your public personality in the band? Because everybody in the band seemed to get this, you know, public persona.
Yeah, I think mine just came in naturally as Mr. Dopey. You know, it's sort of like the comic clown, you know. John had their edge. Paul was Mr. Lovable. Well, I was Mr. Lovable, but the young girls loved him. George was this silent type, and, you know, I was, hi, what's happening? And so that image, of course, especially through Hard Day's Night, is, you know, I've had to battle that since that day. Everybody thinks, oh, that's what he's like. And, of course, he's not like that at all.
Can you give us a sense of what it was like early on when the Beatles' fame started getting, like, so extraordinary that you couldn't go places without attracting crowds? I mean...
Well, you know, we were young boys, and it was exciting where we, you know, we sort of conquered England. That was the first job, you know. Just to get down to London and get in there was heavy enough. And then we'd do the continent. You know, we used to have this saying, oh, well, we've done Sweden, we've conquered Sweden. We've done France now, we've done Italy, you know. And then, of course, we were invited to come to America. And at that time, we were really worried because we'd had two records out here, or they were coming out. Nobody wanted them. And by chance, George came over for a holiday. He was the first one of us to come to America. And, of course, he was going into record shops saying, oh, have you got the Beatles? And they were saying, excuse me, never heard of them. So, you know, he came back saying, oh, they don't know us over there. And, of course, you know, the story goes when Capitol decided to put some money behind us to promote us, and we got off the plane to do Ed Sullivan. We had a number one. I mean, you know, you can't plan things like that. This is just how it is.
Well, that first Ed Sullivan performance is one of the watershed moments in rock and roll history. What are some of your memories of
Ed Sullivan?
Of that show?
Well,
yeah.
Ed, you see, I thought we come to America and it was fabulous, and there was millions of people at the airport and they were lying in the streets and it was yeah, all over the place. And just my mind, I have of Ed to this day, and I don't know if it's actually true, but my impression was Ed Sullivan, you know, I'm waiting for Ed to say, you know, they are, they're all the way from England and it's great and they're going to be fabulous and blah, 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 blah. And it's like Ed said, here they are, the Beatles.
Well, you probably couldn't
just
comprehend,
like, thrown,
the whole... Yeah.
Thrown to the lions. Right. So to this day, I've always thought, God, I mean, we could have done better than that, Ed.
Well, you probably were unfamiliar with the whole Ed Sullivan phenomenon. I mean, the most
low-key,
square person.
Yeah, did not know what it meant. You know, this guy just booked us on a show. We'd go anywhere for a gig.
So when girls started screaming at your performances, did you have any idea what was going on? Like, why the screaming as opposed to anything else?
It started in Liverpool. Mm-hmm. And
so you actually knew where it started?
I mean, it caught on like wildfire all over the world.
Was it frustrating to perform in concerts where you couldn't hear what you were playing because the audience was screaming so loudly?
It got frustrating in the end. At the beginning, it was just fabulous. I mean, you know, if you can imagine you're 22, 23, and you go on stage and all those people are just screaming at you, loving you. I mean, you know, you were making a lot of records and making good records. You know, it was everything you dreamed of. And it just built up and built up. And, of course, around about 65, you know, it started actually to get a little tiring because, you know, we were starting to make really interesting records and we couldn't perform them. And it didn't matter what we did, people were screaming anyway, so no one was listening. And because of that, we were becoming, you know, not the best musicians we would become because we could only play, you know, the actual thing. I mean, for me personally, I, you know, it's very hard to do this on radio, but I could only do the downbeat, you know, check, 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 check. I couldn't do any fills or anything because they would just disappear into the cosmos. So you found yourself, you know, you're just sitting there playing the track, really.
Ringo Starr, recorded in 1995. The Beatles sang All You Need Is Love. The Ruddles spoofed it with All You Need Is Cash, which would be the more appropriate theme for today's program. We're asking you to call with a pledge to support Fresh Air. Here's why we need your cash. Each station that carries Fresh Air has to pay a fee, which goes toward our production budget. Your station relies on Fresh Air listeners to contribute enough money to cover that fee, or else the station can't afford to carry the show. So remember, money can't buy you love, but it can bring you Fresh Air. Thank you very much.
The best things in life are free, but you can keep them for the birds and bees. Now give me money.
That's what I want.
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 Yeah.
That's what I want.
Your love will give me a thrill.
Let's get back to our 1995 interview with Ringo Starr.
Do you have a favorite phase of the Beatles' recording years?
Making the first records was just a thrill. I mean, it was absolutely thrilling. And listening to it on the radio, you know, we would stop the car when we'd be going to a gig somewhere, you'd know, you know, because they didn't play them every 10 minutes. Oh, it's 7:45 on Wednesday, they're going to play your record. And so wherever we were going, we'd stop the car. We're usually in a car and listen to it. And the other thing we did, if it moved up the charts, we would always have a celebratory dinner. So if you look at Beatle photos and Beatle footage, you'd see them getting fatter and fatter and fatter as they were getting more popular, because now we could afford food, you know. But and then, of course, from Rubber Soul on, you know, the records started to really get exciting. Or, you know, the sound, we were really getting into the sound, making sounds, making good sounds. The writing was getting better. You know, everything was picking up. It was really getting good. So, you know, it had a natural progression. So, you know, to say this period or that period, they're all different periods. I mean, I like the White Album. That's one of my favorites, just because it, I felt after Sgt. Pepper, which was brilliant, but it just doesn't happen to be my favorite. The White Album, we were getting back to being a band again. And, you know, that's what the Beatles were. We were a really cool band.
Being a band as opposed to being artfully produced in the studio, is that
sure,
what you mean?
Sure, even though we did it ourselves, you know, suddenly the strings and the brass were taking the center stage around the songs instead of the group.
It's something else about the Beatles, you know. The Beatles were such an important part of music,
life.
Period, you know. And they're really a very small part in your life. I mean, a big part in who you are, but a small
sure.
part in the number of years
sure.
that you were a Beatle.
Yeah.
So I guess I'd like to get a sense of what it means in your life if you still feel like that is so much a part of your existence, or if that's something that you've really tried to move beyond and away from. And
well, I don't think you can move away from it, because you know, it was only 8 years of my life, but it's the 8 years that everybody really associates with. You know, it's like, you know, it doesn't matter, I've made hit records and, you know, I had hit albums and I'm on tour and that. It always comes back to these 8 years of being a Beatle. And I think I just have to resign myself to that's what people want to know about. But, of course, in my life, I've moved on, you know. I've done other things. You know, Barbara and I have been together for 15 years, you know, been married 14. So, you know, the love of my life, who's here with me today, listeners. You know, we have our life, we live together. But, you know, whenever it comes down to something like this, it's always a Beatle program.
Did you want the group to break up? Were you ready for it?
I think we were all ready in a way, because it wasn't as much fun as it used to be. It was okay while we got in the studio for a while, and then, you know, there would be some bickering. And nobody wanted to put in the time, including myself. You know, no one wanted to put in the time and energy that it took later on. You know, we may have done the first album in 12 hours, but the last ones were taking months. And, you know, no one really wanted to put in that time and energy. So it was sort of just like a natural falling apart, really.
What was it like for you musically in the early years after the Beatles split up? Was it easy for you to
no.
establish yourself as a musical identity outside of the Beatles?
No, I had no identity outside of it, really, for myself. I mean, I was, you know, it was the Beatles. I was in the Beatles. I was one of them, and that's what I did. And suddenly we weren't doing that, so I really had to think about what I wanted to do and, you know, where would I take my musical career or any career. And so it took a while, you know, for the dust to settle that finally it's over. And I better pick myself up, dust myself off,
start all over again.
And that's what I did. And, you know, what would I do? So I called George Martin, who, you know, I'd worked with for years, and I decided, you know, I wasn't as prolific a writer as the others. And, you know, I was trying to find myself, so I decided to make an album of nostalgia, really. So I decided to do all the songs that I'd heard at the parties at home, you know, with my parents and my uncles and everybody. And so, you know, I did that album. And then after that, of course, that's when it really took off. I called Richard Perry because Harry Nilsson and I were in or going to Nashville to do the Grammys, and Richard was going. So I'd worked with him through Harry Nilsson. I said, well, while we're in Nashville, why don't we do a few tracks? So Richard said, well, why don't we do this and Nashville stuff? And then why don't we go to L.A.? And make a record, see what we get. And that's what we did, and that's when we got to the Ringo album. And then my career was off and running again.
You know, it's funny, did you feel like...
did I do all the talking then, Terry?
did you ever feel like what you wanted to be was a drummer in a band, but what was expected of you was like a masterpiece record because of, you know...
No, all I wanted to be was the drummer in the band, and then sort of this... Ringo personality came out, you know, with the Octopus's Garden and Yellow Submarine and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, you know, to make the Ringo album, you know, we had to find tracks that really, you know, would show off different facets of my personality. And Richard Perry, you know, was very good at that, finding stuff. And then we'd listen to it and we'd work it out what we could do together. And also on that album, of course, you know, I did have John who wrote me a song. And I did have Paul who wrote a song. And I did have George. So, you know, everyone was playing, really, but we just weren't playing together.
Ringo Starr recorded in 1995. He has a new CD of Christmas songs called I Wanna Be Santa Claus. I'm Terry Gross and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about the Beatles from the point of view of a former Beatle wife. We hear from Cynthia Lennon.
Come on, baby, now.
Come on, baby.
Come on and work it on out.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publishers of A Very Private Woman by Nina Burley, the story of the life and mysterious death of Mary Meyer, in trade paperback. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from Perseus Books, publisher of The Pleasure of Finding Things Out, the best short works of Richard Feynman, with an introduction by Freeman Dyson.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the 60s, when teenage girls in America and England fantasized about romance with their favorite Beatle, Cynthia Lennon was married to John. They shared a working-class background and met in art school in 1957. They were married in 1962. During the years John toured the world, Cynthia was at home, raising their son Julian, who's now a rock star. Cynthia and John divorced in 1968 after John fell in love with Yoko Ono. John was assassinated 12 years later. In 1985, I spoke with Cynthia Lennon about what it was like to be a Beatle wife. She told me that she met John in her second year of college. They got married after she got pregnant. The Beatles were just getting started. When did you realize that something very extraordinary was happening with that group?
Well, they were always extraordinary. Even as youngsters, as students, they were extraordinary. They had charisma about them. They had a great raw energy. And I think it was possibly when they were in Hamburg, when they first went to Hamburg, and they were out of the country, out of their hometown, and they were faced with an audience of ruffians and sailors, and they were working in the Reeper Barn in Hamburg. And they had to cope with different types of audiences, very hard, work very long hours. And that was when the magic started coming out, and that was their apprenticeship.
You were told by Brian Epstein after a while, the Beatles' manager, that you shouldn't be too visible as the wife. They didn't want the fans to know, I think, that that Lennon was married, or at least they didn't want to play it up. I mean, how were you told that? Did he tell you that directly?
Well, he didn't exactly tell me, but he did speak to John about it. And, of course, John explained to me the situation, because in those days it wasn't done for a pop star to have a wife. It would take away from the group. And, of course, the beginning of the Beatles, Brian wanted a lot of adulation from the fans. He wanted a lot of support from the fans. And, of course, it wasn't done. If the lead, in fact, the main man in the group, who was John, was found to be married, then it might take away from that particular success. So I walked around pregnant for quite a long time, hiding it. You know, I'd wear very big blousy clothes, and in fact I was asked many times if I was John's wife, and I had to refuse and say, no, I'm somebody else.
When fans did find out who you were, what kind of emotional reaction did they have toward you? Did a lot of the teenage girls really hate you or become jealous of you because you had the person who was the object of their fantasies?
Not at all. Do you know, I was very lucky, really. I think I expected it. I really was a little worried about it. But all I've ever had from the fans has been love and support. And if there was any envy or jealousy or hate, it didn't come across to me.
Did they want to live through you in a voyeuristic way?
In a way, yes. I think the fact that they wanted to wear the same makeup and wear their hair the same way and wear the same clothes, and that was flattering in a way, but it wasn't antagonistic at all.
It's funny, you know, you mentioned your hair, and you've mentioned that John Lennon wanted you to look like Brigitte Bardot, that he was really fixated on Brigitte Bardot.
Yes, he was. He had plenty of posters of Brigitte Bardot and Mylène de Mongeau and many, all foreign. And, of course, a Liverpool girl trying to emulate that sort of style was something else. I mean, I couldn't change my accent to French, but the one thing that I could do was to grow my hair. And, of course, I started lightening it, and it got lighter and lighter. And then he was very fascinated with black stockings and short skirts. And, you know, for me it was difficult at first because I was pretty conservative. They used to call me Miss Powell. You know, they used to think of me as a sort of secretary type with specs on, glasses on. And I always used to be kidded about it, and they'd always say, oh, here comes Miss Powell. And this was before John and I got together. together. And then, of course, when we did get together, I just... I didn't fall in, but I was influenced by him a lot. You know, of course, I mean, I loved him. So I did as much as I could to please him in that respect. And I pleased myself as well, because I was a little bit fed up with being called Miss Powell.
What was it like in the days when you were a young mother and John was mostly on the road touring and he'd have, I guess, like a couple of weeks here and there in between tours to come home and play the role of husband and father? Was he able to make that transition from rock star and figure of fantasy to young father and husband?
Extremely difficult for him, because even though when he wasn't on the road touring, he was in the recording studio. So we saw very little of him. And when he did come home, he was so exhausted and so tired and so overwhelmed by the pressures of the outside world that when he came home, all he wanted to do was to collapse. I mean, he used to sleep an awful lot. And he would wake up when we were ready to go to bed, if you know what I mean. With a small child, you have to be up early in the morning. And then you're pretty exhausted at night. Whereas John's hours changed. You know, he'd be up at night and in bed during the day. So the whole fabric of our life changed because of the work that he was doing and because of the pressures from outside.
Were you exposed to any of the groupies who were hanging around John Lennon and the other Beatles then?
Well, actually, the first experience, which was funny for all of us, when we first came to New York and we were staying at the Plaza, I think it was Murray the K was there. He was the first disc jockey that we'd ever met, American disc jockey, so I was very impressed, but he happened to be there. And in the room, there were sort of all these draped, beautiful ladies. This was their suite, Murray the K and about five beautiful model ladies all draped round. And we all walked in and looked at them and looked at each other and wondered what on earth we were supposed to do in a situation like this, because it was obvious, you know, what they were there for. And, of course, I was the fly in the ointment because I was the wife of one of the Beatles. So it was embarrassing for them and embarrassing for me. And it was a situation that clicked with me. I mean, I realised then what it was going to be like, you know, in the future. I mean, obviously, that was what it was going to be like, just women throwing themselves at them the whole time.
Well, what would you do in a situation like that? Would you be the one to leave?
No, no. I mean, in a situation like that, no. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you're not there, there's not a lot you can do about it, is there? And, you know, men are very easily tempted when they're exhausted and tired and they need not necessarily sleep. You know, I'm not being crude on this, but I mean, it's one of those situations in that sort of life.
Did you ever have a desire to have other relationships too, since chances were that he was having other relationships?
Not at all. No, I'm a one-man woman. I always have been. And very difficult. You know, I suppose it sounds not boring, but, you know, in this day and age, there's so much infidelity and all sorts of things going on. But no, I'm a one-man woman. And I believed and loved my man at the time. And there was no way I would have dreamt doing anything like that.
One of the changes that he experienced, which I would assume you didn't, at least to that degree, was the introduction of marijuana and hallucinogenic drugs. I mean, the Beatles became famous for mm-hmm. that. Did you participate in any of that? Were you anxious to try it?
I was never anxious to try it. But our first experience was a friend of George's, actually, a dentist person, and we went for dinner, and after dinner he put sugar cubes in our coffee, which were laced with LSD, and of course it hit us all at the same time, and we had the most horrendous night and a very dangerous drive home. We could all have been killed because we were absolutely out of our minds, and for me that was hell, sheer hell, mental torture, and I couldn't cope with it. And I would never, ever have wanted to do it again. And yet for John, it was something else. You see, John was a different animal. He was a searcher. He desired something new in life, constantly changing, constantly wanting new experiences. And, of course, he didn't have a bad time on this particular drug. So he tried it again. And then if you realise at a time like that when there's so much money around and so many hangers-on, there are bound to be pushers, and there were pushers. We were surrounded by pushers. So there was no denying that there was plenty of supplies. You know, they didn't have to do anything. They were captive audiences to these people who are constantly pushing the drugs.
Did that create a wedge between the two of you, since he was living in an altered state a lot of the time and you weren't?
Most definitely, because it's a division of two minds, really. I couldn't go along with it. I just couldn't. I hated the whole business. I could see what it was doing, not necessarily to John, but to a lot of people. Lost a lot of friends through drugs. And with John, it altered his personality for me. I mean, I just stayed the way I was, and I always have done as far as I can. I mean, I've developed and I've gone on. But John was going so fast, and I couldn't keep up with him. And I didn't want to keep up with him on that level.
What are some of the other ways you saw him changed by the fame and the money that he achieved?
I think he became extremely lethargic at home, really rather sad and tired. He just didn't have any stimulation anymore. He was losing out on concert tours. He wasn't happy in his performance because he couldn't hear himself. He wasn't getting any audience response. He wasn't close enough to the people that he was entertaining anymore. I mean, he was surrounded by adulation and material goods and all the things that other people would think were fantastic in life. But for John, it wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough. It wasn't honest enough.
So what did it look like he was going to turn to instead?
Well, I think it was very hard to describe what he was going to turn to. I mean, he was on that particular road. We did turn to meditation and the Maharishi in India.
Did you go to that?
Yes, I was there for 2 months. But he took that wholeheartedly again. And so did George, very, very deeply into meditation. And I didn't. I took half and half, sort of tried to get a balanced view of it. So I would do artwork. Half of my time was doing artwork and half of my time was doing meditation. Because I didn't want to get hooked on anything. You know, I think you've got to believe in yourself and your capabilities. And I think John, again, was looking for an escape. But this time it was a healthy escape. It was escape into meditation, into peace of mind, relaxation, away from the pressures. And it was at this particular time that he met Yoko. And, of course, again, before we went to India, Brian died. So the whole thing, our whole lifestyle changed again very quickly, you know, after the first time. I was constantly changing. And this was a great break and a great rift for all of us. I mean, we're all devastated by Brian's death.
We'll get back to our 1985 interview with Cynthia Lennon after a break. This is Fresh Air.
I want to be your lover, baby. I want to be your man. I want to be your lover, baby. I want to be your man. Love you like no other, baby. Like no other can. Love you like no other, baby, like no other can. I wanna be your man. 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 Tell me that you love me, baby. Let me understand. Tell me that you love me, baby. I wanna be your man. I wanna be your lover, baby. I wanna be your man. I wanna be your lover, baby. I wanna be your man. I wanna be your man. I wanna be your man.
Let's get back to our 1985 interview with Cynthia Lennon. How did you first meet Yoko?
I met her, where was it? Actually, when I came home from a holiday. But I had seen her before. I mean, I met her physically, we could say. And she'd been staying with John the night, and I came home and they were there, which was sort of curtains for our marriage as far as all of us were concerned, really. But I had met her once before at a meditation meeting.
You knew right from the start when you saw them together that this was it, that this was different from just having an affair with someone?
Well, I keep saying it was feminine intuition. You know that something's going to happen, and only you know that something like that is going to happen because of your sensitivity and your knowledge of the person that you've been living with for 10 years already. You know exactly what's going to happen. And as far as Yoko was concerned, I knew there was not a thing I could do about it, any more than there was anything I could do about John taking drugs at the time. There was no way I could have stopped him.
He initiated divorce proceedings, right?
Yes.
And he accused you of adultery.
Well, you see, this is the crazy, the madness of it all. I, to this day, don't understand that, but it's almost as though, I've tried to work it out, it's almost as though John's attitude in life was the best form of defense is attack. Now, he was guilty of letting me down in public. I was on holiday when the information about John and Yoko came out in the newspapers. I didn't know it was open to the world, the situation. And I was on holiday and somebody showed me a newspaper. And then an emissary of John's came over to visit me in Italy and said, John wants a divorce and he wants Julian. And there's a detective. Now, I was on holiday with my mother, my aunt, an uncle, and Julian. So God only knows why there was a detective put on me. You know, it was one of those situations that I will never understand.
You still angry about that?
No, I'm not. I'm really not angry. If I could understand it more, it would be easier. But I didn't get a chance to have an explanation for it. I'm not angry about it. I'm really not. It's just, it's in the past. It's finished. It's done.
Were you able to talk with him? Would he make time to talk with you about the divorce proceedings?
Not really. It was all done through lawyers and solicitors.
That must have been very frustrating.
It was very sad. Very sad that you were cut off so quickly. Cut out of somebody's life so quickly. But there's not a lot I can say about that.
I can't imagine what it was like for you, you know, to, after going from the, you know, fairly conservative childhood to suddenly being in the middle of all the Beatlemania stuff, and then it ends, you know, then there's a divorce and you're still kind of identified with it, but it's in a lot of ways out of your life. And you didn't have the money anymore either.
No. Well, I think it's called survival. It's simple as that. I think you have to survive and you have to keep your feet on the ground and hope for the best and keep on laughing, you know, in life. I'm not laughing now, but I mean, you must carry on. I had a son to look after. I had a child to bring up. And what if I'd fallen by the wayside, what would have happened to him? Very important. Julian was very important to me at that time.
When John and Yoko went off together, their relationship was probably the most press-covered relationship of the year. They were on the cover of everything. Mm-hmm. They were holding press conferences in their bed. I mean, it was one big media event after another. How much of that did you want to expose yourself to? Did you read it?
Oh, I read everything, yes. Because, of course, the man that we had divorced, it didn't mean to say I'd stopped loving him or caring for him or worrying about him. Because I didn't have any anger or bitterness about it. I had a lot of hurt. But of course I was looking after his interests in my own little way and caring about his future and hoping that he was happy because he'd had to go through such hell to do what he did. And he became almost a leper in the eyes of the British and the press. And he had hell to go through because he broke away from the system of being one of the four mop tops that were doing so well and such good ambassadors for Britain. And he moved out of that and he became an individual. And he did what he wanted, to the extreme, as John would always do anyway. And I felt extremely worried for him, really, at that time, because he had to take so much from the press and media and from fans and people who loved him.
How do you think his personality was changed by the relationship?
I think he found his space. I don't think he found the complete satisfaction in life, because I think he was always searching, always looking for it, always wanting something new, always... I mean, he was due to come back to England, you know, near the end, of just before he died. So he was constantly changing and looking for new quests. But whatever he did, it was totally honest and wholehearted.
Cynthia Lennon recorded in 1985. Over the summer in London, she had an exhibition of her cartoons depicting her years with John Lennon. This is Fresh Air. We've brought you a week of interviews from our archive, an archive that we hope has helped document the popular culture of our time. We've been able to do it because our listeners have kept us on the air by tuning us in and supporting us during fundraisers. I hope you'll call now with a pledge. Your station's ability to keep bringing you Fresh Air is dependent on you supporting the program. Thank you very much. After making the film Kundun, set in Tibet, director Martin Scorsese has returned to his home turf of New York City with Bringing Out the Dead. It's based on the acclaimed novel by Joe Connolly and stars Nicolas Cage as an EMS paramedic. Critic John Powers has a review.
It's always been one of the pleasures of Martin Scorsese's work that he takes us inside other people's worlds and shows us how they operate. Watching his movies, we learn the daily rituals of Goodfellas and casino owners, Raging Bull boxers and Tibetan monks. Now, in Bringing Out the Dead, he plunges us into the world of EMS paramedics. Nicolas Cage stars as Frank Pierce, who, as the movie opens, is already flipping out. Patients keep dying on him, he keeps seeing ghosts, and he can't quite get through to his partners, who share little in common but burliness. There's a pragmatic one, played by John Goodman, an ultra-violent one, that's Tom Sizemore, and then there's Ving Rhames, who gives the movie's most enjoyable performance as Marcus, a lusty cigar-smoking Christian. They all spend their nights driving around the city, drinking and yammering and fighting the heebie-jeebies. But while the others are able to treat their work as a job, Frank longs for human connection and spiritual relief. And so he gets involved with Patricia Arquette's character, the daughter of a man Frank rushed to the local ER. But even her presence can't stop Frank's hysteria, which often turns into weird comedy. Here, he and Marcus get a call from a dispatcher that Marcus has the hots for.
Pick up the radio.
But don't do it, Marcus, please. Tell her the bus died. Tell her the radio's not working. Tell her our backs are out. Just, you know, tell her we're too drunk to take any more calls. Okay?
Let's take it!
No.
Six too young, this is Marcus. Only for you, baby. Only for you.
Keep it to yourself, young. Male dip breather approximately 30 West End and 72nd.
10-4, hon. I'm coming, baby.
With its loner hero who steers his way through the hellish Manhattan night, Bringing Out the Dead bears an obvious affinity to Scorsese's Taxi Driver. It even has the same screenwriter, Paul Schrader. But while Taxi Driver was never as good as its reputation suggests, placing it side by side with this new movie makes it clear how Scorsese's work has grown slicker and emptier. Missing is the urban grittiness of Joe Connolly's original novel, or Scorsese's own movies from the 70s. Here, the hospitals are too clean, the hookers too handsomely photographed, the squalor too clearly the work of a production designer. These aren't the mean streets of 90s New York, but Rudy Giuliani's fantasy of a Manhattan where even the garbage is clean. Even worse, the movie lacks feeling. For Frank's story to reach us, we need to believe that he really is haunted by the dead, and we need to share his sense of harrowing melancholy. After all, this movie's about a man who nightly tries to save people's lives in the direst of circumstances, and then bears the weight of his frequent failures. Unfortunately, we never feel the power of this situation. One reason is the casting of Cage, who's played this kind of role so often that his cringes, hollowed eyes, and manic laughter now seem habitual. Yet the real fault lies with Scorsese, who's so busy juicing things up with his style that he doesn't grasp that Frank's story was juicier without it. He fills the screen with camera tricks and lickety-split editing, then gooses the action by blaring anachronistic songs by The Clash. He overdirects this movie in precisely the way that TV commercials are overdirected. There are no memorable images because every shot is trying to be memorable. He never comes close to pulling off what the young director M. Night Shyamalan does so quietly in The Sixth Sense, make us believe in the power of the dead. Like so many artists, Scorsese mined his richest material in his youthful movies like Mean Streets, and he's now struggling to keep his pictures from falling into middle-aged redundancy. There are three ways any artist can do this. He can dig deeper into old ideas, he can find new topics that inspire him, or he can become more and more obsessed with technique. It's this last obsession that has increasingly dominated Scorsese's work, which is one reason why Bringing Out the Dead leaves me so cold. It's all formal pizzazz and no resonance. Rather than taking me somewhere new, it leaves me trapped in the prison house of Scorsese's virtuosity.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Friars Club, the place where showbiz people meet, greet, and roast each other. We'll talk to the director of a new documentary about the Friars, and we'll meet two members, comic Freddie Roman, dean of the New York Friars Club, and Jeffrey Ross, known for his hilarious insults at the roasts. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.